stoke the conflict between China and different Asian countries over territorial waters. So that, you know, Canada's military, Canadian funding to the Canadian military is, you know, in the case of the special forces, in fact, the Ottawa Citizen reported that the contract, the $1.4 billion contract to upgrade the special forces base, in fact, it was signed back in November, and bits of it have begun already, but they waited to make the announcement just before Biden's visit because it was all part of this sort of, you know, hey, we're serving the U.S. empire. The U.S. empire wants us to contribute more to, you know, global warfare, and so it's in the open. It's remarkable, the, you know, the media cheerleads that were, you know, Canada needs to just devote more public resources to the killing machine because the U.S. Wants us to. That's the dominant narrative in our media. You know, the U.S., the day before Biden came, he, you know, bombed Syria again and killed, I think it might 16 people, I think was the number. You know, the U.S. is bombing, I think in the past 20 years, is 330,000 bombs. I think something like a dozen countries the U.S. has dropped. I mean, it's just the idea that we should be, like, you know, contributing more public resources to that war machine is just complete insanity. But that's where the dominant ethos of Canadian political culture is.
Well, and again, reading from this budget release from the DND, they say that it includes 6.1 billion to. Oh, I'm reading from 2022's budget. Jesus, I'm not even got the 23, but in that budget it says 6.1 billion to increase defense capabilities. Improve continental defense. Now that's the buzzword, continental defense, which means it's not necessarily for us, it's for our whole continent, which is actually the United States. But throughout all the money they're spending, they keep on insisting that they're doing all this to stand ready to defend our security, Canadians' security, and we'll always be there for Canadians. I mean, Canadians, Canadians, Canadians appears so many times in this first paragraph. You write, and we've talked about in the past, if the Canadian government, if push came to shove, we're not sure whose side they would come in on if, say, the Americans decided, oh, well, we're tired of the vagaries of Canadian democracy, we're going to just take over. It's not entirely certain who the Canadian military would defend, the American interests or those of the citizenry here.
Oh, I mean, I think there's a very high likelihood that if there was a socialist-minded government that was breaking away from NATO and NORAD that, you know, the Canadian military would try to overthrow that government. But what I go one step further, I've joked, you know, probably true that if the U.S. military invaded Canada, that the Canadian military would support that invasion because the Canadian military supports every U.S. invasion everywhere, right? They're so integrated to the U.S. military structure that it's almost impossible for the U.S. to go, you know, NORAD, if people talk about NORAD as being defense. Well, NORAD radar systems support U.S. bombing all over the world today, right? They, you know, Canadians, so there's just so many different ways the Canadian military is tied into the U.S. military that it would be assisting an invasion. So, I mean, all that's kind of like eliminated from the discussion, as is, you know, like just the UN experts talked about all these war crimes taking place in Libya. Both against Libyans and against migrants in Libya. Here now, 12 years later, since Canada oversaw the NATO campaign bombing Libya, the country's still divided, horrible human rights situation. And you won't even find, you basically never find any media outlet that even references Canada's, you know, role in that disaster that continues today. Another one on a little bit that, And that was pointed out in by Scott Taylor, you know, kind of he represents sort of the dissent end of the military. He points out that, you know, we're all this, you know, we're sending naval vessels to off the South China Sea, and we're all this ramping up of rhetoric around China, the belligerent China. Well, China spends 1.3% of its GDP on its military. That's the same amount as Canada spends on its military. So we're supposed to be, we have to ramp up our military spending because we have to keep up with the big, bad, aggressive, militaristic China. But you know, China spends the same amount on its GDP. It's the U.S. that spends about three times its proportion of GDP on the military than Canada and you know, than China. So there's so many of these elements when you dig down into it and you you ask yourself these questions about Mexico. Okay, so so why is, you know, why wouldn't Mexico, if Canada is such a under such a threat from China, why wouldn't Mexico also be under that, like, kind of equivalent sort of geographically? You know, Mexico had barely has even has an air force. I think it's like $6 billion that Mexico spends on its military, whereas Canada is something around $30 billion. You know, and so, right, like, these questions are just not even kind of asked, and everyone who knows, everyone who thinks about it for a second knows there's only one country that could possibly invade Canada, and that's the U.S. And so that's not an argument to, like, build up a military force to stop American invasion. It's an argument, I think, in fact, to spend less on the military and to support those forces within U.S. society that also want to spend less on the military and bolster those forces rather than bolstering the militaristic forces by participating in NORAD and NATO and Five Eyes, like we do today.
Well, and looking at some of the releases from DND, they're predictable. Like, every sentence begins talking about Canada, Canadian sovereignty and defense. You know, our safety is primal. But before the sentence peters out, it stresses that we're protecting not only all of those things, but the protecting North America and supporting our allies around the world. Well, our allies around the world, NATO, the United States. But this means sending, as you mentioned earlier, the ships are off to the China Sea, protecting Canada from thousands of miles away. These super expensive F-35s are going to be sent, you know, who knows where, under NORAD's umbrella or some other. They'll be dropping bombs, as they did in Libya, on some far-flung country for the goals of NATO and the United States, not to protect Canada at all. At least it would be the furthest stretch from it. But in your article, Eve, you mentioned earlier about Dwyer Hill, and this is with the JTF-2. Can you, what I found in your article so worrying was the fact that the definition of JTF-2 and the way it's used, they've got this $1.4 billion additional dollars that you mentioned, but the fact that JF2, they aren't really answerable the way that the rest of the Canadian military is. Do you want to go into that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty simple. There's two things. They, the reasons why, you know, JTF2 was created in 1993 and Canadian Special Forces Command in 2006, and now it's about 2,500 members. And there's two reasons why they want this. One is they're elite, and they are. I mean, you should, when you read about, like, the training they have to go through and the exercise they have to go through to progress in, you know, to become a member of JTF2, which is the elite of the elite within the Canadian military. It's you know, these are impressive warriors, if you want to use their language. Now, the other side to that is that it's secretive, right? So from the Canadian government standpoint and the military standpoint, why they building up the special forces is because they can deploy them and the public is none the wiser. So what we hear about, we can't confirm. It's not like a 100% that Canadian special forces were on the ground in Libya. There's reports that they were. I'm talking about in 2011. There's reports that they were. There's the fact that the closest confirmation we have is that their colors in the post-war parade, that was big parade that Harper organized, that their colors appeared. This is coming from Scott Taylor, who witnessed it. That's, you know, that's the confirmation, but it was never publicly reported. Now, that's a big deal because
Scott Taylor, you've sorry to cut in, but he's a pretty solid source of this kind of information.
He's esprit du corps, and he was he was in the military for many years, and he's a very, very prominent military reporter. But the fact that we don't know this is really important, because the United Nations Security Council Resolution 1973 was absolutely explicit when giving this no-fly zone, which, you know, they of course violated by ultimately killing Gaddafi, but even by backing the rebels, the no-fly zone was supposed to be just about protecting civilians, and they violated by expanding it, you know, that definition greatly. But it explicitly said no foreign forces on the ground, and so the fact that there were Canadian Special Forces on the ground, which is not, we can't confirm to 100%, but pretty close to that, means that we were in you know, explicit violation of international law. And so, yeah, from the Canadian government's perspective, that's appealing. You know, in 2019, there was this footage that the Haiti Information Project found, or they had somebody at the Port-au-Prince airport, Toussaint Louverture airport in Port-au-Prince, and they saw these four undercovers with these big guns, these like big dudes, white dudes, of course, in Haiti, and again, we're not 100% sure they were Canadian Special Forces, but I reached out to an important military reporter, and he was pretty certain that two of them were JTF2, and two were the other Special Forces. But again, there was never a press release. There was never any statement. We don't exactly know what they were doing. There's all kind of, you know, Haiti Information Project had their speculation. Same thing, the night that Aristide was taken out by U.S. Marines in 2004, Agence France-Presse reported that Canadian Special Forces were at the Toussaint Louverture airport. A few days before Aristide was ousted, David Puglisi at the Ottawa Citizen reported that Canadian Special Forces had been dispatched to Haiti, but it was all framed as protecting the Canadian ambassador and so the secretive component is a important part of what they're all about from both the decision makers and the military's perspective, which runs counter, quite frankly, to democracy.
Well, and diplomatically as well, because Canada famously said it wasn't going to take part militarily in the Iraq War, the second one. And you have a list of where these special forces have been deployed: Iraq, Yugoslavia, Colombia, Peru. I don't know what was going on there, Afghanistan, naturally, but also Ukraine. Do we know we've known that Canadian military has been in Ukraine, in the western part of Ukraine, training and supplying the coup government, the Kiev coup government there for quite a long time. But there's been rumors that it goes further than that, involving JTF2.
Yeah, well, New York Times reported that Canadian Special Forces were on the ground in a story that talked about U.S. Special Forces, said also Canadian. There was one or two other countries that they included. Then that's maybe about 6 months ago. Then a couple months after that, then in response to that, Puglisi at the Ottawa Citizen contacted, and they said we won't confirm or deny. And then about a month after that, Global News confirmed that there were Canadian Special Forces on the ground. It was the Anita Anand, the defense minister's response to these questions was quite interesting. She just basically said the journalists were being unpatriotic by asking the questions. It was almost just like that direct. So they played up. I mean, they used the fact that they operated secrecy to not have that come public. You know, in the case of the Peru thing, right? The Peru thing was the during Fujimori's dictatorship in Peru in 96, I believe it was, the rebels took the Japanese leftist guerrilla group took the Japanese embassy and a bunch of hostages. And in the book, Nous Étions Invincibles, which is the only book, it's a former Special Forces JTF2 officer who wrote it. It was blocked. The military blocked it from being published, and he was actually charged because they signed these like confidentiality agreements even after they leave. He talked about how they were dispatched to Peru during that, and that was like a massacre. They killed all the guerrillas when they finally went into the embassy. It was like a long 30-day, 50-day hostage kind of situation. In that book, he discusses being dispatched to Colombia and being pursued by the FARC rebels. And he didn't know that he was trying to get this prominent, the son of a top Colombian politician out of a situation, and so the FARC like pursued them hard and like actually killed, I believe, one or two of the, it was with some American special forces. He made these claims. It's a really serious book, and he details it all out. We can't be sure it's true because it's all operating in this sort of secretive kind of domain. But again, same thing, David Puglisi has a book about Canadian Special Forces where he talks about them being dispatched to Congo. There's a crazy story in the mid-90s in the Congo and coming under attack. How widely the Canadian government is dispatching these special forces is unclear, but they are dispatching them, and they aren't telling us about it.
Well, what they tell us about the budgets too. I wonder how much, what kind of a dark budget exists there as well. Again, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking with Eve Engler. Eve's an independent Montreal-based journalist. He's an author, written a dozen books on Canadian foreign policy. His website is eveengler.com. I'm just going through, honestly, some of his recent work. You're a pretty busy guy over there, Eve. And now, I guess everybody that is paying attention knows that what's going on in Ukraine and this contretemps with Russia is merely a prelude, an entree for what's expected to be a larger conflagration with China. Your article, Canada Orders Double Standard on Military-Academic Ties, is a disturbing look at some of the propaganda efforts in this country. I remember seeing Chinese academics being vilified in the United States. I don't know, this was like 3 years ago, maybe, or four, just before the Meng Wanzhou kidnapping by the Canadian government and all that. But they were hunting down academics in Chinese nationals working at American universities and even Americans with Chinese heritage. Now, this sounds to me like there's something similar going on here. Am I jumping to conclusions?
No, it's pretty explicitly following the U.S. Playbook or some of what's happened in the U.S. A CIA-linked firm based in Salt Lake City put out a report, or probably fed their report to the Globe and Mail, about how all these Canadian universities and academics had collaborated one way or another with Chinese academics that were tied to – that had – collaborated with the Chinese military, and the Globe put it on the front page a couple of days, and it prompted and other media picked up from there, and it prompted the federal government to bring in these restrictions around the education's a provincial jurisdiction, but the federal government's responsible for all these big national funding research funding initiatives. So basically restrict Canadian academics' access to that funding if they collaborate in any way with some Chinese academic that has any connection to the Chinese military. And while they're doing that, I mean, I don't, the idea of getting militaries off of university campuses and out of research, I broadly am quite sympathetic to that idea. But the reality is that there's Canadian universities that not just that the Canadian academics who collaborate with U.S. academics that have funding from the U.S. military. I mean, there's probably, you know, like 20% of all Canadian academics are do that, because there's so many American academics have, you know, some relationship to the U.S. military. But there's actually Canadian universities that announce contracts for U.S. military research initiatives. There's, you know, we're talking about millions and millions. One at UBC, that's like $5 million. It was just announced not long ago, $5 million that a Canadian academic got for to do a research for the U.S. military. So, you know, they announce it, Dalhousie. I quote this release, press releases from Dalhousie, where they announce these U.S. Military officials coming up to like, you know, talk about what they have on offer and, you know, get involved in some of these some of this stuff. And of course, there's a long history of Canadian academics having provide all kinds of support for U.S. You know, biological and chemical weapon programs and all kinds of stuff that that's you know, strengthened U.S. military power and is, I think, most people would consider pretty odious kind of.
Well, don't they even set up stalls, like career fair stalls in universities? You know, come and join the U.S. Department of Defense and do the research that you always wanted to do, etc.
Yeah, I haven't like, you know, done a deep research dive into it, but yeah, that's essentially what the Dalhousie press releases were doing. And we should also mention, of course, you know, Canadian military is a huge funder of academic research, but and probably if you looked into it, I bet you the UK, I bet the Canadian academics have more ties to British academics that are tied to the British military than they do, you know, Chinese academics that have connections to the Chinese military. And probably same thing, you look at, you know, the Israeli military, French military even. So this is all part of this sort of, you know, China's our enemy, even though, I mean, you know, who could possibly argue that the Chinese military is a more nefarious institution than the U.S. military? I mean, the U.S. military is just...
The CBC, we hear it every single day, don't we? Jesus. But Eve, we're fast running out of time, but I don't want to leave before getting to your mild questioning, but not questioning that she's used to, I suppose, of Canada's Right Honourable Minister of Sports, Pascal Saint-Ange. Do you want to talk a little bit about your meeting? You've got up at your website, Sports Minister Embarrasses Herself and Servile Canadian Media, about a little bit about your recent encounter with the minister. Do you want to talk a little bit about that in our final few minutes?
Yeah, you know, between trying to that morning, Justin Trudeau was speaking at the Palais des Congrès here in Montreal, and then he was speaking at another event which I didn't know where it was, but I thought it was somewhere downtown, which it didn't end up being. Between that, I trying to find Trudeau, I came across the fact that the sports minister was doing this press event tour at this. At this tech company in downtown Old Montreal. I went to this tour. It was basically a tour of like hothouse technology, you know, like hothouse tomatoes. And so I went to this thing and I waited for the minister for about 20 minutes. I was supposed to be able to ask a question. And her media flack sort of seemed, basically I told her my name, and then I think she did. I know she did a search of my name, and then started having doubts and basically.
Gee, why?
I understood that I wasn't just the normal kind of reporter that would just ask, you know, whatever completely unimportant question. And so rather than allow me to ask this question at the end, her media people tried to kind of hustle her out of the room. But I sort of stopped to ask her this question about, you know, on what's the moral grounds at which you're making the decisions to say that Russian and Belarusian athletes shouldn't be able to participate in international sporting competitions. And Saint-Ange has been an aggressive proponent of that, saying that even they shouldn't even be allowed to participate under you know, a neutral banner, not even. And so she's been a real hard proponent of that. And I said, well, do you feel the same way when after the U.S. invaded Iraq? And I asked the question. So she stopped to, you know, she's right next to me. I had a good video of her hearing the question. When she heard the question, she does this great little smirk, and looks away, looks back at me, and then just like bolts out of the room. And then I followed her. And I said, well, how about Canadian athletes after the bombing of Libya or Afghanistan? And she just keeps walking. And then she has to wait for the elevator in the room. And she's like, I asked them, well, how about Israeli athletes with their occupation and apartheid? And stands waiting for the elevator, looks very uncomfortable. And then she gets in the elevator, refuses to say anything. And I pause. I give her some time to, like, you know, to respond, nothing. And her assistant is being very politely trying to divert me away and not allow the question to be kind of hang out in the air, and then she just gets in the elevator and goes off. The video clip is mine on my Twitter, 1.4 million views, and my guess is it's over 5 million people that have seen it, because there's another on Facebook that has 1.2 million Arab in Facebook, and it's translated in all kinds of languages. And I think it's, you know, how she responds to it is pretty good. Like, it's a good minute long, kind of some drama to it. But I think that what was sort of appealing about it is it's a really simple question, right? I think a question that, like, many people have had on their minds, and yet all these journalists who have regular access to the sports minister and, you know, other ministers never ask, right? Yeah. So I'm asking this really simple question, and she's just completely, either unable or refuses to respond to it. So I think that, you know, it's not just it's an obvious embarrassment of her, but it's and the government, but it's an embarrassment of, quite frankly, of the whole, like, media sphere that has not bothered to ask the question. And you know, I got, you know, Al Jazeera had me on, a number of international, Venezuelan media reported, Chinese media, Russian media, Turkish media reported on it, but no Canadian media.
Well, I saw it. I actually saw it on Jimmy Dore, which is a pretty prominent American show, online show. And there's two screensave images of the minister. The second one, with her little smirk, it's like she's saying, oh, behave, you know, and it's like it's all just a joke, but it's not so much. But it does prove Canadian hypocrisy. And when it comes to sports, it's apples and oranges. Couldn't resist that one. Eve, that's all the time we got. Again, eveangler.com to find Eve's work. You're busy as crap, I see, and you're writing great stuff as always, and getting in the face and asking the tough questions, and even the easy questions that are too tough for Canadian media to ask. You're a credit to your nation, Eve.
Thank you. Thanks.
Okay. Till the next time then, eh?
Take care. Thanks, Chris.
All right.
The economy collapsed back in 1929. The New Deal threw out a lifeline. They passed laws back then to regulate the banks, to control the base impulses within the bankers' ranks. But by 1999, Glass-Steagall was repealed. The leash was off the bankers, and they had a field day investing our deposits in lots of risky bets, thinking only of the most profit they could get. It was 2008, and the panic was on. The banks were all collapsing, the boom times were gone, the panic was on. The panic was on. Homeowners couldn't pay all those mortgages subprime that the bankers had been selling so much of the time. So Congress took action and bailed out the rich with their message for the rest of us. Ain't life a bitch? It was 2008 and the panic was on. The banks were all collapsing, the boom times were gone, the panic was on. The panic was on. Then they passed legislation to re-regulate the banks. Kinda like the old laws called Dodd-Frank. Enter Jamie Dimon, John Stumpf, and Greg Becker, who threw around their money like some plutocratic wrecker. And once they got the law repealed, they still had cash to burn to make lots more bad investments with a very high return. Like any Ponzi scheme, it fell apart, and then me and my fellow Americans are left to bail them out again. Yeah, it's 2023 and the panic is on. The banks are all collapsing.